Modern societies are collectively deeply committed to education and have in place the mechanisms needed to teach every conceivable profession and to cover every topic of inquiry. We reliably educate pilots and neurosurgeons, actuaries and dental hygienists. We offer lessons in the irregularities of the French pluperfect and textbooks on the conductive properties of metal alloys. We are not individually much cleverer than the average animal, a heron or a mole. The slowest among us can, in a few hours, pick up ideas that it took a few rare geniuses a lifetime to acquire. Yet, what is distinctive is just how selective we are about the topics we deem it possible to educate ourselves in. Our energies are overwhelmingly directed towards material, scientific, and technical subjects, and away from psychological and emotional ones. Much anxiety surrounds the question of how good the next generation will be at maths, very little around their abilities at marriage or kindness. We devote inordinate hours to learning about tectonic plates and cloud formations, and relatively few fathoming shame and rage. The assumption is that emotional insight might be either unnecessary or, in essence, unteachable, lying beyond reason or method, an unreproducible phenomenon best abandoned to individual instinct and intuition. We are left to find our own path around our unfeasibly complicated minds, a move as striking and as wise as suggesting that each generation should rediscover the laws of physics by themselves. The battle for the branches begins. There's not a speck of space for the blossoms, so a corresponding number of leaves must vacate their posts. In the years when the leaves shrivel and fall off, the trees look unusually bare, so it's no surprise that reports on the condition of forests where the affected trees are growing describe the tree canopy as being in a pitiful state. Because all the trees are going through this process at the same time, to a casual observer, the forest looks sick. The forest is not sick, but it is vulnerable. The argument for studying the effect of the city on the individual seems self-evident. It is the fate of many of us to live in cities, and we ought to understand how this social fact shapes feeling, action, and thought. By the mid-60s, social psychology had studied interaction with smaller units, but it had not yet examined how the person is affected by the extended urban environment. Urban questions had a well-entrenched tradition in sociology, but for some reason, the social psychologist had preferred to examine small-scale social relationships, the dyad, the small group, or, in his most expansive moments, intergroup relations.